His Excellency, the Most Reverend Bishop Fulton J. Sheen.
Friends, the few minutes before television program begins are always moments of tension. There's a countdown, and one is always waiting for the cue to start. It reminds me of a woman in an Arkansas town, a very small town. She was trying to crash the society in this village, but her husband was not very social, so she kept him upstairs with instructions that he was not to come down to the tea under any circumstances. She invited in the ladies, and she was charming them at tea, and her efforts were just about crowned with success when a voice was heard from upstairs. It was the husband, and he was saying, "Ma, there are only clean towels in the bathroom. Is it all right to start one?" So we get the cue and start a television show. And this one is about America. Sometimes the Europeans make great fun of us. This really and truly happened to a friend of mine who was studying in Switzerland. And it seems this American had gone over for his first visit to Europe. And my friend in Switzerland, who was an American, said, "Well, how do you like Europe?" "Oh," he said, "I don't like anything about it." He said, "They're not up to date. They do not have the latest gadgets. The television not in the hotel rooms." And then he said, "Buildings are old." He said, "There are churches here that are over 1,000 years old." And then, "Dirty. I don't find anything beautiful here." My American friend said, "Well, don't you think Switzerland is beautiful?" He said, "Take away the scenery and what have you got left?" There are so many things that we take for granted now that could not be taken for granted some years ago. For example, our next meal. When the pioneers had to go out to shoot it. Water. But now, we take everything for granted. Light, heat, transportation, television, trains and planes. We take our friends for granted. Take people for granted. And we take America for granted. And there is going on at the present time a decline in patriotism. And in order to revive it, let me tell you some of the glories of America. I'm going to mention three. The first is the origin of our rights and liberties. Secondly, the great value that we put upon the human person. And then thirdly, what America's done for the world. First of all, the source of our rights and liberties. Where, for example, do I get the right of free speech here? Whence comes freedom of press, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion? There's an audience here in this studio. They are an assembly. Whence comes the right of assembly? Don't you think that our founding fathers had to ask themselves these questions? Where do our rights come from? And liberties as well. From the state? If the state gave our rights, the state could take them away. Does the federal government give us our rights and liberties? If the federal government gave us our rights and liberties, the federal government could take them away. On March the 15th, we feel it takes almost everything else away and might take away our rights and liberties. Our founding fathers had to ask themselves these questions, and they searched about for some basis and some ground of our liberties. And they looked to one theory that was being held in Europe at the time. namely that rights and liberties come from Parliament. Founding fathers rejected that. Then they considered another theory. That they come from the will of the majority. And rightly, they refused to accept that view. They wanted a country in which rights and liberties did not come from the will of the majority in an election. They wanted a country in which the majority would be the custodian of minority rights. And they finally found the source of rights and liberties, and they set it down in the second paragraph of our Declaration of Independence. It is a self-evident principle that the Creator, has endowed man with certain unalienable rights, among which are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In other words, our rights come from God. And therefore, no one can take them away. That's very different from any theory that might exist in a totalitarian system. This is why we call now all of our rights and liberties inalienable. The Constitution puts it unalienable, but the meaning is the same. Now, if our rights came from a party, then the party could destroy them. And so we have in our Constitution, Article 9. And Article 9 of the Constitution states, when the Constitution grants rights and liberties to the citizens, it must never be assumed that the people have no other rights than those granted to them by the Constitution. In other words, simply because we have certain rights, we must never think that we have them because they're in the Constitution. No, we have them because they're divinely given. And we do not have to wait for all of our rights and liberties in the enumeration by a Bill of Rights or the Constitution. See, our country has theological foundations. In other words, our Declaration of Independence is a declaration of dependence. We are independent because we are dependent on God. If we wish to keep our rights and liberties, or rather our trees, we have to keep our forests. If we wish to keep our light and heat, we must keep our sun. If we wish to keep our perfumes, we must keep our flowers. If we wish to keep our rights and liberties, we must also keep our God. Piety and patriotism go together. That's the first glory of being an American. And then there's another. And this second glory has to do with the value that our government puts upon the human person. Have you ever noticed how our Constitution begins? It begins, you see, no matter what I talk about, my angel cleans my board for me. Even though it's on the Constitution, he still works faithfully. Now here is the way our Constitution begins. We, the people, decree and ordain a Constitution. Who are people? What makes people? Persons. Make people. What is a person? A person is someone who answers the question, who is it? A person is one who has rights and liberties, even though he is not useful, like a baby, or a sick person. But above all, a person is one who cannot be replaced, like your mother, father, wife, husband, so forth. And a person is one who is self-determined. In other words, a person is one who has a right to go in and look at 20 pairs of shoes in a shoe store and not buy a one. The determination comes from inside oneself, not from the outside. One is not pressured. Persons are not the same. Here I'm going to become technical for a moment. Persons are not the same as individuals. When you go to the store to buy oranges, you say, well, I don't like that orange. Put in another. But you can't say that about persons. A mother who has five children can't say, oh, no, I don't like that one. Give me another one. She has it. So individuals are very often just things. Now, our Constitution states that we are made up of persons. And persons in community constitute people. This has great bearing in the politics of the world today. What's the contrast? Of what does communism speak? People? No. Masses. Who are masses? There are persons who began to be individuals, who lost all sense of responsibility, and then began to be amalgamated into a mass. And all the direction of the masses comes from outside of the persons. They are not self-determining. It's the party that determines. It's the dictator that determines. We are not masses. We are people. One can beware of anyone who speaks. Therefore, the American nation is being made up of masses. Karl Marx, who founded communism, said, the individual has no value, the person has no value, except he is a member of the Communist Party. If he's not a member of the party, he has no value. We say he has value independent of any party. I remember some years ago, Haywood Bruin, the great journalist, told me of a friend of his who was a cartoonist for the Daily Worker, which was the communist daily in New York City. And this cartoonist had developed cancer and was unable to work. And he was living in great poverty. And Bruin, who had a profound love of humanity, went to the Communist Party of New York and asked them if they please wouldn't do something for this man who had dedicated his whole life to them and has used his talents in drawing cartoons for their paper every day. And the party said to Bruin, he doesn't exist anymore. He no longer has value for the party. Therefore, he's of no importance. We cannot help him. The greatness of America, therefore, is its belief in the value of a man. That's why we're interested in just one citizen who might be taken prisoner in another country. And where does this stem from? It stems from, after all, the Christian tradition. One wonders if really the Christian part of democracy was not grounded and founded on that day when our blessed Lord was unfurled like a wounded eagle on the cross, and he turned to a thief on the side of him and addressed him in the second person singular, saying, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise, called a sheep by name." Everyone had a value because he was a person and therefore bore the image and likeness of God. This is the second glory of being an American. And the third and final, though there are more, but you do not have time to develop them all, it's our relationship to the rest of the world. Look at what we have been to the world since our beginning. The very beginning of our national history was one in which the United States was a sanctuary to the persecuted peoples of the world. In other words, those who were suffering from any kind of intolerance could come to our shores. And that still is true. Just as there was a ring on the door of certain churches in the Middle Ages where a criminal was pursued by law, could have recourse. If he touched that ring, he was immune from civil prosecution, threw himself upon the mercies of God and the church. And we've been that sanctuary to peoples of other lands. And then we became an arsenal. We were an arsenal in two world wars. And we did not gain one inch of territory. Nor did we ask for it. Very few instances will you find in history in which a nation took hold of the enemy immediately after the war and lifted it up. Who became the strong nations after the war? The defeated ones. Japan, Germany, Italy. We reached out a hand to them. Loved our enemies. Were happy when the war was over. Then we became, and this is what we are at the present moment, we are a pantry. A pantry to the world in as much as we are helping to feed the world. And I'm speaking not just of giving money, because that does not make many friends. I rather speak of the food that we are sending to the 2/3 of the people of the world who go to bed hungry every night. Do you not think that this is going to draw down upon us many of the blessings of God? While we find complaints, there are always complaints in any human temporal society, nevertheless, I believe really and truly that we are destined under providence to be a secondary cause for the preservation of the liberties of the world. We have indeed a task that is not easy. Because the people that are being pursued by totalitarian states have to depend upon us. And Providence has asked us to succor them. We're something like Simon of Cyrene. Remember, here was this man from Africa, where Cyrene was in Africa, who on Good Friday morning stationed himself along a roadway
roadway to Calvary. He was just curious as any man was curious about a fellow man going to death. And as he stood there, the long arm of the Roman law reached out to him. And the Roman law said to him, "Take up that cross. Carry it." He did not want to do it. But he carried it. After a while, the burden became sweet and the yoke light. And so it is with America. Here is a great part of the world laboring under communism and in danger of being consumed by it is on this terrible roadway of modern politics, and Providence is laying its hand on the shoulder of Americans saying, "Take up their cross, carry it." And we're carrying a nobler cross than we know, and even a nobler cross than we deserve. Yes, we're brought close to danger, that is true, and we're like the eagles, you know, that build their nests high in the crevices, always overlooking abysses. And then when the mother eagle has hatched out the young, she will push one of the young birds over the nest. And the little eagle will fly, fall down to what must seem like certain death. Just before it crashes in the rocks below, the mother eagle swoops down and gathers up its young on its giant pinions, flies into the air, and then out from under the bird, catches it again before it falls, repeats the process until the bird has learned to fly. And so America's pushed close and close, very often to disaster. And yet Providence, somehow or other, each time, is gathering us on its giant wings. As Moses said, as God stirs the eagle stirs among its young, so God stirs among the nations, and particularly our own. And that maybe is why we, in the profundity of our vocation, have chosen as our symbol not a serpent, not a lion seeking the one whom it would devour, but we've chosen as our national symbol an eagle flying upwards and onwards to the source of all our rights and liberties, unto God. The Greeks used to speak of piety. And by piety they meant the love of God, love of neighbor, and love of country. Be proud of your country, as Paul was proud, saying, "Civis Romanus sum, I am a Roman." So I am an American. By now, and God love you.